This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So it's a pleasure to introduce our panelists. Now, James Fallows from Atlantic Magazine is visiting with us. I'm happy to say he's a frequent visitor to UCSD and to San Diego. He is, of course, the national correspondent for Atlantic Magazine. He and his wife, Deb, lived in China for 3 years. He wrote a really wonderful book called China Airborne, so he is really the perfect person to moderate our discussion this evening. And in addition to moderating the discussion, he's also going to help Barry Naughton, who has been stricken by laryngitis, communicate the content of Barry's PowerPoint because he can't talk. So Barry Naughton, my wonderful colleague at the School of Global Policy and Strategy, is America's leading economist working on China, author of many books. He is definitely the go-to person on the Chinese economy for issues related to macro policy, industrial competitiveness, firms and how they operate, economic reform, and he has been working actively on issues related to innovation in China. Taiming Chung is also a professor at GPS and the director of the UC System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. He is a leading expert on China's defense and national security issues. He's been working for a very long time on the dual-use technologies and the importance of China's science and technology for its national security strategy and its military capabilities. Peter Cowie is our wonderful dean, who is also the Qualcomm Endowed Chair in Communications and Technology Policy, and he is a leading expert on the future of communication technologies and their implications for global trade and economic cooperation. So he's now working on a new book on digital technology and global competitiveness. So I'm sure you'll agree, even before they've uttered a word, that this is a very, very strong group of experts, and they all teach, do research, and work here at UCSD. So that's really great. So I'm sorry I took so long. I'm so excited about it. And I'd like to turn it now over to Jim Fallows to moderate the discussion. Thank you.
As a journalist, I live for the opportunity to interview experts like these, to ask them what's really going on here, what's really going on there. I'm going to try to replicate some of that journalistic experience during the discussion period of our program after we hear the initial presentations, one of which I will deliver in the mode of Professor Barry Naughton. And we'll get to that in a moment. Also, all of us, journalists, students, professors, citizens, whatever, we come to universities to hear new things. Ideally, that's what we come to universities for, and to have our old ideas challenged. One of the ideas that is most in my mind as we begin this session is what I fear might be an old idea. When I was last on the stage with Peter Cowie a couple of years ago, I had published my book, China Airborne, and Peter was interviewing me about it, and I was putting forward one idea of Chinese innovation that I fear may now be an outdated idea. So we'll see. That's one of the things we're going to have answered in the course of this discussion. I was saying that in the past 30 years, the Chinese economy had shown its tremendous power in taking a nation from peasantry to what I was describing as Dickensian industrial life, of going from the farm to the steel factory and the outsourcing factory. And the question was whether the next 30 years would show the same kind of progress, a progress towards a true rich country industrial base with China's own brand names, China's own innovation, or whether it would just be a bigger version of the same thing. And by the same thing, you know the consequences for environment and for the middle income trap and all the rest. And a hypothesis I was putting forward in my book is that it would be difficult for China to make this transition, to shift to the truly rich country model, the innovative model, the kind of wealth generation we find in the U.S. and Western Europe and Japan and South Korea, if it stuck to the same political model that controls on universities and limits on intellectual property protection and the internet and all the rest would produce some kind of tension. But it's possible that that is too simple and too wishful thinking a model from Westerners to say, well, they can't have it both ways. They can't have the political control they're looking for and the really innovation-based economy they would like to have. And so that's one of the hypotheses we're going to explore in the next while. First, we're going to have initial presentations by our panelists and some guided discussion, then questions at the end that from the audience. And what I hope to hear is whether we should think differently about the new innovation model China has launched, whether it actually is a new model or just something that's called new, what the consequences are for the people of China, the businesses of China, their neighbors and competitors in East Asia, and for the United States and for other countries, existing rich countries that view themselves as defenders of the existing order, the existing standards, etc. So we're going to do this here's the following the plan. We're going to hear first from Taiming Chung, and he's going to talk about the very interesting focus he's been doing on in China's new model of innovation and what he's found out. So we'll hear from him first. Then we're going to hear from Barry Naughton through the means of me, telling you about how to think about some of the larger economic issues in China as they are reified through this plan. Then we're going to hear from Peter Cowie about how to think of this from an international perspective, a historical perspective, and the big picture, which deans are in business to give. So that will be, and then I'll have some questions for the panelists. Barry Naughton can see whether he wants me to answer questions in his mode. You can come whisper in my ear at that point, and then I'll turn the questions over to you. So with that, let me give you Taiming Chung, who's going to set up what you've been learning about China's innovation model.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here. And I'm going to do this in a very low-tech way itself, even though we're talking about innovation. There's a presentation and there's been some handouts itself. So I'll refer to handouts because there's some very interesting graphics on there that I also want to explain. So the focus of my presentation is to look at what the Chinese authorities mean by innovation and how does it fit into China's search for a new development model, because that's one of the key things that the leadership of Xi Jinping is trying to do, to shift to new modes of development, new modes of global competitiveness. So one of the things that you hear when you listen to whether it's Xi Jinping, the Prime Minister Li Keqiang, or the rest of the Chinese leadership in the last few years is about innovation. Innovation has become sort of the mantra of the new development, the search for this new development model. But the question is, what does it actually mean? And as the Chinese authorities look at where they've been over the last couple decades, what other countries are doing, and where they're going to be placing a lot of their bets over the next 10, 20, 30 years, they talk about three types of innovation that is critical for their long-term roadmap. And in the presentation, there's a very interesting photograph of Xi Jinping. One of the first things that he did when he came to power is that he bought the entire Politburo to China's equivalent of Silicon Valley, Zhongguan Chun, and said, innovation is where we're going to be focusing in my leadership itself. The rest of the leadership in the photograph, they look a little baffled itself because most of them haven't really focused about innovation. But it shows you that innovation is one of the top political priorities for the leadership. So what are these three types of innovation that the Chinese leadership emphasizes. The first one is sort of what they aspire to over the long term is what they call original innovation. And this is, to define it, this is sort of scientific discovery that produces novel output with global impact itself. So it has to be novel, and it has to have a global impact. And this is something that the Chinese authorities are investing a lot of effort of resources. They're developing, it's like the foundations of a new highly competitive innovation ecosystem with universities, research institutes at the very heart, but they're not there yet. And it's going to take quite a long time. The Chinese, I mean, the Chinese nation, they've had a very proud record of innovation and invention historically. Of course, when we always think about Chinese innovation, I mean, we always think about it from a historical point. The compass, the printing press, money, it was all came from China itself. But one of the questions I ask in my classes to my students is like, there's sort of, over the last 50, 60 years, there's only been one innovation that the Chinese have done that can be really defined as original innovation itself. And if anyone can answer itself, I'll give you an A for the grads. Does anyone know? If not, it's their photograph is there. It's hybrid rice. That's the real only original global innovation. The Chinese are doing a lot of effort, but they haven't really done anything that has had profound. So that's the very top. The second type of innovation is what the Chinese call integrated innovation. In Chinese, it's jicheng, chuangxing. And this is sort of what they're beginning to do itself. Integrated innovation is sort of like what the Chinese think about systems of systems, or what the Japanese industry did sort of in the 1980s, early 1990s. Companies such as Toyota and Sony, it's like when you have a very tight integration of research and development, of design and manufacturing, linked in with marketing or strategic doctrines, this is intended to produce much better product itself. So you have the researchers, the engineers, the designers, the marketers, all working very, very closely itself. And this is what in academia we call sort of architectural in innovation. The technology might not be completely brand new, but when you link in with the design, with the marketing, with the output side, it has a much more revolutionary impact. And the Chinese are beginning to do that itself. In the area that I look at, in national security and defense, they've been doing it in areas with ballistic missiles, what we call anti-ship ballistic missiles, that is having a profound impact on the security environment in the region. The third type of innovation, which is where the center of gravity is at present, is what the Chinese call re-innovation itself, zai chuangxing, which is you absorb imported technologies, and then you improve upon that. You make it so like Chinese characteristics itself. And this is sort of a low-risk, high-reward approach itself. So for anyone who's been to China, I mean, there's one of the best examples of re-innovation, of where they absorb foreign technologies and reverse engineer and improve on it, is high-speed trains. I mean, high-speed trains are something that the Chinese were not very good at trains for a very long, long time. In the early 2000s, they were able to import German, French, Canadian, Japanese technologies. And with the space of a few years, they developed their own high-speed train system, and today they're sort of the world leaders. And we've seen it in trains. We're seeing it now in many other industries, the nuclear sector, aviation, in all sorts of areas. And what we see is that the Chinese have built a very increasingly sophisticated industrial economy that has this like re-innovation itself. So the re-innovation is very good, but it's ultimately it's a catch-up model. So what the Chinese want to do now is to move up to the integrated, to the original innovation. And I think the next 5 to 10 years is a critical period of time. In 2016, the Chinese have come out with a number of new long-term plans. The 13th five-year plan. Last year, they came out with a Made in China 2025 plan to talk about advanced manufacturing, or the Internet Plus plan about how you use cloud computing, etc. So the Chinese authorities are really thinking. It's like, well, we have our own approaches. And we're looking to be able to build upon the re-innovation, which they've done very, very well, but now moving further up. And to Jim's question, I mean, it's like, can they actually make that itself? I mean, it's like the leadership says, it's like, I mean, we don't have a choice, especially with the shift to this new development model where innovation and consumption very tightly entwined. They'll do whatever is necessary on that.
Great. Thank you very much for setting that up so clearly with these three levels of innovation they're trying to achieve: the original innovation, the sort of the fundamental research, the integrated innovation with systems of systems, and this kind of catch-up innovation. Let me just ask you one clarification question before I turn to my role as Barry Naughton. The first time I came to UCSD was in the mid-1980s, interview Chalmers Johnson, when I was then living in Japan, and of course hearing about his developmental economics model. And there's some generic similarity between the scheme you're setting out here and what he was talking about with Japan, South Korea, et cetera. Fundamentally, is this the Japanese or South Korean model, or fundamentally, is it different?
It's very similar to the Japanese and the Korean model. The big difference is that the Japanese and Korean models, they did their development in the late industrial period. This is in the information era itself, which means that there are more differences than similarities in critical areas.
Great. So we'll come back to that later on. Now you're going to hear from me in the mode of Professor Barry Naughton, who is bravely here even though he cannot talk, and the person who is most empathetic for Professor Naughton right now is my wife, Deb, because twice during our career traveling around together, once in Norway, once in Chicago, I was scheduled to give a speech and simply could not talk. And Deb had the starring role. I might actually invite Deb up here to... would you like to read this? Okay, well, so you're going to get me as a substitute, not only for Barry Naughton, but also for Deb Fallows. So this is going to be a perspective from America's great expert on the Chinese economy, and the title is China, an Alternative Model for Innovation. That is, there's something, question mark. Is there a way in which their model is different in its effectiveness and its concept? In the past 2 months, China has unexpectedly launched a new initiative, which it calls supply-side structural reforms. The name in Chinese is here, but I'm not going to read it for you, but Professor Naughton can tell you later. The program was even elaborated upon in a very long piece in the People's Daily on January 4th, 2016, by an authoritative personage. What can this new initiative mean? Supply-side structural reforms has a sudden new emphasis on aggressively restructuring. I'm going to give you five different elements of this supply-side structural reforms. Number one is to close down excess capacity. We're all familiar with that as part of the legacy of China's overinvestment in recent years. Number two is writing off inventories. Number three is to deleverage, write down debt. Number four is to reduce costs. And number five is to fill in the missing pieces. Professor Naughton can tell you at another time all the sort of details of this. I'm giving you the five-point summary now. And all of these signal a new determination to restructure and reduce debt and close down excess capacity at the same time. That is managing the transition that all experts have said is necessary for the Chinese economy as part of the new program. It's important to recognize that this is no recognition of failure in the previous Chinese economic model, but instead a relaunch. So some illustrations of the way it's being branded as a relaunch as opposed to an admission of failure. Number one, the Chinese government does not acknowledge failure, which is a useful point. Number two, the launch of supply-side structural reforms is nonetheless a tacit acknowledgement that the approach to economic reform in place since 2013 hasn't been working. In a parallel way, recent Chinese innovation policy represents a tacit acknowledgement that past innovation policy has been overly costly and with meager results. The new policies contain many new elements, but no slacking of commitment. So the Chinese government is implicitly recognizing the approach both for structural reform and for promoting innovation has not really worked, but without saying that, they're going to try a different and redoubled approach. Two new principles are woven throughout these new policies. Number one is it's less targeted to specific companies, that is, local champions, and more use of incentives that are universally available. This would seem from an international perspective to be a sort of recognition of economic fundamentals rather than trying to create the local champions. And number two is less direct allocation of government money, more use of investment funds, co-funding arrangements, and takeovers of firms with valuable technologies. These are two good principles, Professor Naughton says, that clearly reflect lessons learned of ways that things have not gone the right way in recent years. The doubling down of these new policies is manifest in the following ways. Number one is a massive increase in the amount of money the Chinese government is willing to spend on these innovation and restructuring efforts. Illustration of this, electric vehicles. There's a target of cumulative sales of 5 million vehicles by 2020, going to spend 390 billion RMB in subsidies to consumers. That's over $60 billion in subsidies in this electric vehicles category. Another illustration is integrated circuits. Private equity, with that term in quotes, funds, are expected to total about $150 billion, including some private participation. The Beijing municipality has already put up $10 billion and the national government $30 billion for these buyout funds. This is all in the integrated circuit category. In addition, there's an almost mass campaign-like approach to starting new businesses. One of the slogans is, entrepreneurial masses, innovative people. I'd like to hear one of our candidates say that. I think if Bernie Sanders did that, that would be a sign of the socialist label spilling over. Entrepreneurial masses, innovative people. Everybody do startups, everybody innovate. But the turn here is that this combination of trying to have a more private market approach, but still with government guidance, has already begun to create some problems. For example, the 2015 subsidies for electric vehicles can amount to about $15,000 for a commercial vehicle and $100,000 for a small bus, if you combine central and local government initiatives. These are supposed to step down 20% per year beginning in 2016. Result number one of these very large subsidies is a very rapid growth of production. More than 63,000 electric vehicles were produced last month alone, much more than the rest of the world combined. Result number two, none of you will be surprised to hear, is widespread fraud, production of shoddy vans with cheap electric motors. The number of electric vehicles registered is only half that of the electric vehicles produced. As a side note here, this is me, Jim Fallows, talking, not Barry Naughton. This reminds me of when I was touring up in northeast China during the wind power boom. And we'll see fields and fields of just turbine blades for supposed windmills. You know, people had gotten the subsidy to produce the turbine blades, but they weren't connected to anything and weren't doing any generation of power. There also are some quality problems. And I have a number of pictures here, all with the rubric spontaneous ignition of batteries is a problem the EV industry faces worldwide. There's a number of pictures of batteries bursting into flame with a firemen putting them out. Question, is this combination of elements, a new emphasis, no acknowledgement of failure, but redoubling extra money, is it likely to be successful? It has lots of money, it has a mobilizational style, and it has an attempt to design more incentive-compatible delivery mechanisms. There will be successes, but likely at a prodigious cost. And so that is, to summarize again, this is me. We have after Tai Ming-cheng's presentation of the goals of some of this innovation policy, we have Barry Naughton talking about the way it's been implemented in this startup model that has been supply-side structural reforms, and we see some things that are different. We see extra money. We see a mobilizational effort. We see some of the predictable both successes and weaknesses of the Chinese model. And so the conclusion is, again, there will be successes, likely at prodigious cost, and the net of the success and the cost, I guess, is what we will watch. So I'm going to ask you to join me now in thanking Professor Naughton for writing this wonderful presentation. So I now give you Dean Peter Cowie, who has written, thought, worked, spoken on both the U.S. national strategy on some of these innovation policies worldwide and, crucially, on the harmonization among these efforts internationally, how the U.S. can coexist with and benefit in a regime where China is trying to do these things, other countries are too. What's the international and the U.S. perspective on these developments in China?
Well, thanks very much, Jim. And I do want to note that Barry was wise to trust Jim. You know, the art of being an academic is allowing your fellow scholar to be brilliant and then add that little touch that you claim is your differentiation. But Jim was being a true journalist, reporting the facts accurately in this case. What I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about both the nature of the changes of innovation worldwide and the U.S.-China dynamic in this change in innovation. I think it's important in the United States, when we start to talk about the rise of China as an innovative country, that we recognize that although that poses a commercial challenge to U.S. interests, there is a common interest in China being successful as an innovation country. And that common interest is simply that the growth of technical and scientific knowledge is ultimately a global collective good. Knowledge is not contained sharply inside any national boundary. It spills over and leads to further innovation and discovery. And the characteristic of the world economy for roughly the last 250 years has been an acceleration in the growth of the creation of this common stock of diffusing knowledge around the world that has propelled innovation forward and allowed a breakthrough in the standard of living of all people in the world. So it is not in the American interest to have China fail as an innovator. This is going to be the country that has enormous capacity to invest in scientific, engineering, medical discovery. And if we start with that as understanding that we share a common interest, it also translates into areas where we know that there can be some common commercial interests. For example, China is, if it is to meet its goals for clean energy, which all of us who care about climate change should hope that they do, is supposed to spend roughly $6 trillion in the next 20 to 30 years in renovating its energy system. And there will be substantial opportunities for foreign firms besides Chinese firms in that operation. Now, having said that, I want to turn to both the tensions and between our two countries and the challenges of innovation itself. And I want to do that by first looking at the question of tensions. Does anybody know what the first law was passed by the United States Congress after the Constitution was in place when we elected a Congress?
I mean, is it patents?
No, it was a tariff.
Oh.
All right. In a time of political tension, taking it out on foreign commercial interests is always a good idea as a political move. And we should understand that although we ascribe unique motives to the Chinese leadership and how they often treat foreign interests, that there is a common thread in countries' histories that as they go through significant economic and political change, it's always tempting to buy off local support by exerting penalties on foreign competitors. And that is certainly true in China, that there is a political incentive to have that in the mix of policy, even as China proclaims that it wants to be part of an integrated global market on both sides, both as the recipients of foreign technology and investment and imports, and not just as an exporter of manufactured goods, but as a growing investor around the world through multinational corporations arising from China. In terms of innovation today, there are a large number of fears by U.S. firms about Chinese tactics and behavior. I don't want to go through a laundry list of those. Instead, I want to focus on two particular things that I think that we should watch for. The first is what I call the early innovation stage and the challenges facing that. And then the second is the growth of parallel economic institutions at a global level. Now, in the sorts of markets that we're going to face in the future, we are going to see more and more of the dynamics of traditional markets looking a lot like what we think of as information technology markets. As Jim, who's written a lot about this subject, knows, the characteristic in information technology markets is that you enter after a short while a period of rapid growth, and there tends to be some dominant early winners as people establish the equivalent of platforms and architectures around which other people design as complementary goods and services. Think of Microsoft, think of Intel, think of lots of the big successful information technology companies. Now, digital technology is becoming ubiquitous in traditional goods and services. The whole story of the change in the automobile is about the fact that digital technology is changing both what it is to be an automobile. The newest generations of Mercedes-Benzes have more software code in them than most of the frontline jet fighters of the United States. All right? It is the largest chunk of value added in a Mercedes-Benz. It's spreading to the fact that for all of you who have home alarm systems, these are basically now digital systems that are being produced, and many of them are networked back as they're being used into the cloud. It doesn't matter what service you're talking about. Take medical services. The whole nature of the medical system is changing dramatically because of the ability to use digital information. It's allowing changes in biotechnology itself, the fundamental tools of medicine, and it's changing how we're going to provide medical services. So with that higher infusion of digital technology, you're going to see these markets taking on very quirky new types of characteristics from their traditional ways. So when Ty told you about the difference between an integrated innovation model and a novel product model, we often thought of novel product markets as having these sorts of dynamic bursts of takeoff and clustering around early winners. But this is going to happen more and more in what we used to think of as more traditional technology markets as well. So as we get these bursts of innovation in all sorts of industries, we're going to see a big risk. And it can be understood by thinking about the situation that occurred in China with the growth of the internet as one example. Why is it that Google has failed in China? Why is it that Amazon is a struggling presence in China? Well, it's partly because of the fact that Chinese entrepreneurs in the internet space have been very good at customizing their services and innovating. They deserve a lot of credit for that. But the other part of it was that by a combination of policies, whether it was denial of commercial presence or censorship or a whole variety of other means, in the crucial period of the takeoff of the Chinese internet market, the American firms were not there. And the alternative firms were able to establish themselves as the dominant platforms or architectures for the Chinese internet service market. A similar thing may be occurring today in genomically related medicine, where China is restricting the movement of Chinese genetic data outside of the country in order, they say, to protect national security and privacy, but as a consequence, also limiting the ability of foreign firms to really establish the same sort of threshold in the Chinese market. So these are the problems of denial of entry at an early stage. One of the problems that we have in the use of our international economic policy, Donald Trump notwithstanding, is that it takes a while to both frame a case that is a compelling case that their other country is doing something bad, and second of all, to negotiate and make progress against the particular things you're objecting. And those early years can be crucial. So that issue of the early takeoff of markets is going to be one which we're going to have to watch. The second thing I think that we've got to think about is the growth of a new set of parallel economic institutions out of China. And I want to take this by saying a word by analogy again to the internet. One of the big debates going on globally today is a debate between China and Russia and a number of developing countries, and the United States and Western Europe and Japan and others, about how the internet should be governed globally. And the United States' position is that the internet has succeeded by having a set of arrangements for coordinating the networks that we interconnect through the internet that's done essentially by a structure of nonprofit expert groups operating at a global level, operating by consensus and technical problem solving. And the U.S. and its fellow-minded citizens around the world have advocated keeping a system that has succeeded so well so far. The Chinese have come back and said, no, that's not acceptable. States control their digital space. States are sovereign over their digital space. States should have control and oversight over the internet policy and decision-making space. Now, to do that, China wants to reinvent the internet governance system. Something like that is starting to occur in other fronts as well. Here's one example. You heard in Barry's presentation about the immense amount of money China is putting into these investment funds for things like semiconductors. And one way to understand this, as Barry said, is that this is moving to less targeted interventions in favor of specific firms and allowing something more like we would think of as an investment equity fund to make bets in the marketplace. But the nature of these funds is that they are also strongly controlled to the government, either because they are subsidiaries of state-owned enterprises or because of the queuing mechanism inside China. These funds understand that they are supposed to respond to queues from the central government. Well, that's fine. That's their right. But what you should understand is that one of the biggest complaints of the United States and other countries against China in regards to its technology policies is the use of government subsidies for Chinese companies against to make them stronger against foreign competition. And one way of reading the rise of these new quote-unquote equity funds is that the Chinese can now say, oh, we don't subsidize these companies. They just get investment from these equity funds. And thus, they walk around the rule against certain types of subsidies, which are illegal under international trade rules. Some of you may have read, if you really have a love for obscure facts about China, about the effort to create a new rule and set of laws about the governance of non-profit, non-governmental organizations inside China. We usually talk about this in the ways of how will it affect what we think of as classic NGOs, whether it's for the environment or something else. But this set of laws also would mean that much of the decision-making we do in governance for digital technologies, which is set in the field of setting technical standards, because the standards actually define much of the market dynamics, the United States has always taken the position this should be private sector, voluntary standard setting, and private associations. Government can always step in if something has gone wrong, but this should be left to the private sector. If you have this registration law in China, all the standard setting organizations operating in China will be subject to government registration and oversight by the Public Security Bureau. All right? This is what I mean about parallel economic institutions. So those are the risks, as an example, of things for foreign commercial interests in China. That doesn't mean that everything in China is bleak. But what I am trying to say is these are the things that we have to watch for. The last point I want to make is, so what are the risks for China from this strategy? I want to build off of a couple of things that Barry said. And the first risk, I think, for China in the current moment is really about decision-making in a different sense than Barry talked about. And we are seeing a moment where we have a Chinese president, President Xi, centralizing political power around him and taking direct control over economic and technology policymaking underneath his personal thumb. Now, this is an extraordinary set of actions. And one of the things you have to worry about in a country like China, where the state still pervades so much of the economy, the vast predominance of the economy through indirect means of state-owned enterprises and the like, is that you want a very skilled and, if you would, independent technocratic establishment to be implementing these policies. And what the President Xi's centralization of political control may be doing in the long term is weakening the growth of that Chinese technocratic establishment. And if that occurs, along with the continued strong hand of the central government across the board in the Chinese economy, China could be running into some serious economic management problems. This is something to be watched as a possibility. The other point I want to just make is that when the government assumes so much steering, whether it's by more indirect mechanisms or more direct mechanisms, it is invested in particular classes of outcomes and particular classes of firms, even if not individual firms. And it becomes caught up in all the standard interests that firms build. You know, I've been a regulator in the United States in the communications industry, and one of the things that was always fascinating to watch with digital technology disrupting the hundreds of billions of dollars in the U.S. communications markets was how many firms thought about the problem in light of their existing business model, how they made money under a given set of investment and marketing proposals, and things they knew how to do well. What happens in a digital world is essentially that all those models get called into question. If you want a way of thinking about this concretely, go back in time. Go to the moment when Apple disrupted the music industry. And what Apple did was take the conventional wisdom of the day, which was that content is king and hardware is a commodity. And it invented something called the iPod. And what did Apple say? Content is a commodity. It's going to cost a dollar. All the money is going to be made off of the hardware and software system. All right? You had to reinvent the business model to get innovation. And in doing that, it upset all the established business bets of the dominant players in that market, like Sony. So what happens for a country like China as it faces this volatile new era of innovation is there are going to be requirements to constantly have inversions of business models. And yet the state has its friends. Politics are there. Those are very, very hard moments. Governments can be pretty good at having some good policies to push things forward, but it's when you have to push them sideways or upside down that the political rubber hits the innovation road.
Great. Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you. So I'd like to ask one or two clarifying questions to both to Ty and Peter about the implications of what they're saying, and then I'll turn it over to the audience for some of your questions too. So the title, this is for Ty, the title of our session here is China, an alternative model for innovation? And so we heard from you in your presentation, very interesting presentation about the different goals they have, different kind of innovations they'd like to present. Barry Naughton was telling us about the new effort they're putting into this, different labelings they have, they're redoubling and all this. And Peter was talking about some of the ways in which they're trying to reconfigure the competitive landscape. Is it worth thinking of this as an alternative model? Is there anything different about the concept of how businesses and societies innovate, or is this a different Chinese practices we should think as being applied to the same old model that other countries have used to innovate all the way along?
I think it's a bit of both itself. What I see what's going on in China, and as you mentioned, it's a catch-up model. They're transitioning to be on the front frontier. And a lot of countries have gone there, especially in East Asia. The Japanese have done that, the South Koreans have done that, and other countries itself. So a lot of what I see in China is not exceptionalist itself. They're standard approaches of development. I guess the difference is it's in these other countries itself, they were much more open, they were much more democratic, etc. And the Chinese system is a much more authoritarian system. And for that, when you look at which countries have reached this level of innovation and development, both on the commercial side and on the strategic side itself, even when the Soviet Union, they never was there. They did it on the national security side, but they never did it on the commercial side. So this is something that very, very few countries have done. So that's the difference that the Chinese are facing. They're doing this. They've had some similar experiences with smaller countries itself. But but for developing states, I think China is having to find its own path itself. And so that's the challenge that they have to face. And they are trying to have different bets itself. So they are looking to do these three different models itself because they don't quite know which ones work. And the good thing about the Chinese system is that it's very adaptable itself. They can mobilize, and if it doesn't go wrong, if it goes wrong, they can change as long as they don't call it a failure itself. The big question is they have lots of resources now itself. But it's at some point, if you make these bets and they don't pay off, you begin to run down your resources. So I think it's the Chinese system is they still has a little while, but I think that as Barry mentioned, if some of these economic reforms are not going well itself, and we've seen in the last year or so, they've had these problems, and if they don't find an appropriate and sustainable new development model, they could be in real trouble itself.
And so to push one more time before asking a question to Peter, part of the perhaps naive model I was advancing a couple of years ago on Chinese innovation was to say that it's no coincidence that today's rich societies all have sort of liberal, rich economies have liberal societies too. They have independent universities. They have participatory democracy, et cetera. And so is there anything in China's record so far that makes you think that China can prove an exception to that? They can become truly innovative and rich without having a liberal society?
That's a fascinating question. I think the jury is out on that. I mean, the Chinese leadership obviously thinks that they can do this, that they can be both innovative and authoritarian itself. I think that in certain areas they can do that, especially because the Chinese model continues to be a top-down itself, even if though they are trying to make some bottom-up itself. And I think when you look at the research and the academic literature itself, it's actually there hasn't been very good studies itself. That you need political liberalization to allow real true innovation. I mean, you can have elements that are not political. You can have independent legal system, greater transparency and accountability, and you can have that in an authoritarian system itself. And those are some of the key enablers for innovation. You need information sharing, etc. And the Chinese are trying to find ways to allow that with real red lines in some of the more sensitive areas, I think. So, I mean, the Chinese leadership, it's like, I think it's they have to thread it's like a very thin needle itself, so there's very little margin for error. But I don't think it's like there's no historical precedent that says that they can't do that.
Peter, I know you have views on this, but I'm going to ask you a different question, which is from, and you're welcome to offer your views on that too. But the question is this: you very interestingly and thoroughly portrayed the balance between the cooperative elements of China's growth in the world system and also some of the exclusionary potential there. If you have a model of innovation that involves kind of excluding foreign competitors from the market. In the now almost 40 years of U.S. interaction with China, there's been recognition of this mixed bag, but a sense that the positive outweighed the negative. And is there reason to take the now three, almost 4 years of political increasing control in China, increasing nationalization in its economic policy, increasing aggressiveness in its military policy, as a sign that the balance is tipping, that the negative is outweighing the positive, and some reassessment on the U.S. side of what China's innovation and growth means for the world system and for the United States?
Well, there's the question that we should ask presidential candidates. And I don't think a 45% tariff on Chinese imports will be the solution that will work one way or the other. But let me try to break this into two parts. The first is, assuming that there are negative parts of the Chinese strategy for the U.S., which there clearly are, where's the critical point that we should worry about and where we don't have good tools? And my view is it's this, it's especially in this area of the rapid early explosion of markets as they take off in places like China. Because all of our tools in trade and economic diplomacy tend to have a long lag time in their effectiveness. We're pretty good at stopping short-term specific items. You know, China floats a proposed new mandatory standard for something that will favor Chinese firms over U.S. firms. Well, all the countries in the old established industrial world get together and they yell and they scream and they put pressure on China, and that piece gets taken off. But there's 12 other policy instruments, and effectively foreign firms are blocked. And if I'm right that more and more markets are going to have some of these explosive imprints of early leaders having a strong staying power as a broader rule, I think we're going to have to find ways of responding to that. And so that's going to be a challenge. Now, the second part of it, though, I think is really about what the U.S. does to put its house in order. In the end, trade policy is not equipped with a large enough hammer to change a great power's behavior on these sorts of things in a decisive way. What changes the behavior of countries is when the facts on the ground globally change around them. And the example that I always think about is Japan, where we had a 25-year run of escalating trade disputes and diplomatic pressure by the United States to break open the Japanese market. You covered it as a journalist. And we made some progress in doing that. But in the end, what changed the Japanese story was that their innovation model failed in comparison to the U.S. innovation model at a key turning point. And when Japan suddenly faced the fact that, for example, in the digital industries, the internet changed the basic way that you needed to organize information technology, the Japanese had many of the components needed for that type of architecture, but they didn't have the overall vision of how they fit together, and that opened up the door for the U.S. companies to retake a lead. And after that, the Japanese suddenly became much more cooperative on the trade and market arrangements, right? So I think that the question we face with China is simply this. Are we willing to invest in a country in shoring up our capacity as an innovator, in the ways that we do best. Not every country is going to follow the exact same innovation model. Germany's innovation model is different than the American innovation model. We're both pretty successful at it in our own way. But what the United States has not been doing for the last 20 years is investing at the same level in its innovation model as it should. And that, to me, is a very serious challenge for the United States.
So I'm going to ask you, and segue from that, ask each of you one last question, and then we'll turn it over to the audience. Peter was just saying that the Japanese changed their strategy when there became evidence that their innovation model was not working, and all the challenges we have domestically. Tai, as you look at this new approach China is taking to innovation, what is the signal or the marker that to you will be a bellwether, this is working or this is not? What are the indicator you're going to be looking for?
So there's a whole range of indicators. I guess it's one of the key things for the Chinese is they can dominate the domestic markets itself. And so as Peter's mentioned, it's they can shut out. But what they really need to do is to be competitive at the international levels itself. And it's and if they don't get companies with global brands, if they can't really break into those areas in a broad range of areas itself, then I think that's going to be the biggest problem set for them. They have a large domestic market itself, but it's insufficient for the amounts of investments and for the development model that they need. So they're trying to do things like the one belt, one road to develop some of their own markets, etc. But it has to go beyond that. It has to be much, much more global itself. So one of the things I look at is on the streets of the U.S., how many Chinese cars do we get itself? How much in terms in the digital space itself? And right now, it's still a long ways to go for the Chinese in that.
Great. Thank you. Peter, what is the indicator you are looking for from China for the important innovation trends?
Well, I agree with Tai that the issue for the high end of the Chinese innovation economy is their ability to expand globally. And they've set, as you know, a goal of having Chinese brands and companies expanding on the global stage. So far, that is a pretty mixed bag. Most of foreign direct investment out of China is still from state-owned enterprises. They are making a major effort to buy themselves into the high-end ecosystem technologically in areas like semiconductors today. But that goes to the very heart of the challenge for China, which is the semiconductor industry is facing one of those moments when it's likely to be reorganized in some fundamentally new ways in the next 10 years as technology shifts. And making those bets and pursuing them properly is going to be a huge challenge. So I agree with Tai about this verdict. But I do want to stress that shouldn't make you feel good. There's still lots of innovation going on the ground. The biggest robotics power in the world may be technically Japan, but China is where a lot of the real key technologies are developing right now.
One test of a good discussion is that you learn something. I certainly feel as if I've learned a lot in the last hour and a half. Another test is if you want to keep talking after it's done. So it's better to leave these things wanting more rather than wanting less. I'd like you, please, to join me in thanking Professor Barry Naughton Susan Schur, Clement Chung, and Peter Cowies for a great discussion. So thank you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.